Mr. Lee Young Lee is an internationally known, frequently anthologized, and widely respected contemporary poet. He was born in 1957 in Jakarta, Indonesia, to Chinese parents. In 1959, his father, after spending a year as a political prisoner in President Sukarno's jails, escaped Indonesia with his family. Between 1959 and 1964, they traveled in several Asian countries before arriving in America. Mr. Lee has studied at the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Arizona, and the State University of New York College at Brockport. He has also taught and lectured at numerous colleges and universities. His books of poetry include Book of My Nights, Rose, winner of the Delmore Schwartz Memorial Award from New York University, and The City in Which I Love You, the 1990 Lamont Poetry Selection from the Academy of American Poets. He is also author of an autobiography, The Winged Seed. His honors include fellowships from the National Endowments of the Arts, the Lannan Foundation, and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, as well as grants from the Illinois Arts Council, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania Council of Arts. In 1988, he was the recipient of the Writer's Award from the Mrs. Giles Whiting Foundation. He lives in Chicago with his wife, Dawn, and their children. Let's give Mr. Lee Young Lee a warm welcome to Brigham Young University.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here. This is daunting. I don't know. I always thought my poems, I feel more comfortable reading them across a kitchen table. But this is, I don't know, maybe this is right. It makes me feel really lonely up here. You know, I was really sweating this because I was wondering what... I spend all day long thinking about poetry and writing poems, and I have thoughts and ideas about poetry, and it never dawns on me that I would have to talk about them publicly. And, you know, you have ideas that float around in your head, and they sound okay. When you say them out loud, they sound ridiculous. But I'm going to, I guess, venture that way. I'm going to say, I'd like to read some poems, but maybe I'll say some things in order to set up a context in which to hear these poems. I'm interested in making poems that are a score for human speech. The poem is like a musical score, you know. If you have a musical score, you play an instrument to it. And I see the poem as a musical score for human speech. And that led me to think about speech itself. And if we notice, if we pay attention to speech, we notice that all speech is done with the exhaled breath. You can't talk and inhale at the same time. That poses certain problems. When we breathe in, our bodies are filled with life. There's scientific proof, in fact, that when we inhale, our blood is filled with oxygen, our skin gets flush with nutrition, our bones actually get very compacted, and our muscles get very flush and toned. You could think of that as the in-feeding breath, that we feed on the air. The problem is, when we exhale, our bones actually soften, our muscles become flaccid, and nutrients begin to leave our skin and our blood. The tragedy of that kind of situation is that when we speak with this exhale, this outgoing breath. So while we feed on the world in silence, when we speak about the world, we have to exhale. Now, if you think about it, the more I say, if you speak, the more you say, the more your meaning gets divulged. So that meaning grows in opposite ratio to vitality. Does that make sense? Because the more I speak, the more out of breath I get. but the more my meaning grows. This is, I think, a tragic situation and inescapable, because it's a paradigm for human living. As we die, the meaning of our lives gets divulged. And if it's divine meaning, I think then that's a way to ransom this dying breath, to make it more worthwhile. I think people who write poetry are either consciously or unconsciously anxiety-ridden about this condition. I'm getting some weird looks. Am I losing you people? No? Okay. I think people who write poems are unusually anxiety-ridden about this state of affairs, and what they try to do is they try to ransom the dying breath by packing as much content into the divulged meaning, the disclosed meaning, as possible. That becomes difficult, because when you're trying to enfold as much emotional, psychological, erotic, intellectual content into what you're saying, sometimes the meaning gets so impacted it becomes barely, it escapes the intellect. And what you end up having to do, you end up with somebody like Emily Dickinson, and you spend years unpacking what she means in a poem. I think that accounts for the difficulty of reading poetry. But at the same time, that's poetry's gift, that it can pack so much into so little space. So in that way, it's like DNA. You know, it's really tiny, but there's a lot of information packed into it. It's not only paradigmatic, I think, of our living, but it might be paradigmatic of our relationship to the Godhead, because it seems to me that there's another, I call it tragic, but it might not have to be. It seems that the more we, the more we manifest divinity in our own lives, the more sometimes our temporal selves gets displaced. So you could think about it this way. When I breathe in fact, you can try this when you go home. When you breathe in, your body feels really comfortable. In fact, you could inhale up to, I knew a man, what was my father, he could inhale for 3 minutes and exhale for 3 minutes. And in fact, he taught us to do this practice. You should try that when you're praying. Do the inhalation and exhalation. It's a crazy experience. But what happens is, when you inhale, the ego is affirmed. The body feels very present. And when you exhale, if you exhale to completion, most of us don't, unless you do it consciously, when you exhale to completion, you begin to discover you become very uncomfortable. Your body begins to grasp for breath. But as I said, that's the only way meaning gets made. So it's very interesting that the body mind, the ego mind, if you want to think about it that way, has to get displaced for meaning to disclose itself. I can't promise that you'll hear anything of that profound in these poems, but that's been my attempt and my ambition. You know, I was reading the words to this hymn we just sang, and it refers to God, I guess, as a in the male pronoun. And I've been working on a poem in which the God term asserts itself as a female pronoun. And I thought maybe today I'll read one section of the poem in the way I wrote it, with the female pronoun, and then I'll try to read it with the male pronoun and see how that works. I don't know why throughout my life the God presence has asserted itself often as a female pronoun, as a female presence, often even as a beloved, which is very problematic. So this is called Living with Her. Have I lost all of you? Okay. This is called living with her. Living with her. She opens her eyes, and I see. She counts the birds, and I hear the names of the months and the days. She tells her dream, and I remember. Origin is destiny. A girl, one of her names is change, and my childhood lasted all of an evening. Called light, she breathes, my living share of every moment emerging. Called life, she is a pomegranate, pecked clean by birds, and entirely become a part of their flying. Do you love me? She asks. I love you, she answers. And the world keeps beginning. Now I'd like to read this with a male pronoun and see how it sounds. Maybe one more little thing. You know, I know that's kind of a strange thing to say. Do you love me? She asks. And I love you, she answers. I think that comes from my conviction that all the world exists because God keeps asking, do you love me? And God keeps answering, I love you. And it's not even me answering, I love you, you know. And it's not even me asking, do you love me, to God. Maybe that's a kind of a terrifying vision that all there is God, you know. It's God asking, do you love me? And God answering, do you love, I love you. And I don't know where I fit in. But let me try this. This would be called living with him. Living with him. He opens his eyes, and I see. He counts the birds, and I hear the names of the months and the days. He tells his dream, and I remember. Origin is destiny. A boy, one of his names is change. And my childhood lasted all of an evening. Called light, he breathes, my living share of every moment emerging. Called life, he is a pomegranate, pecked clean by birds, and entirely become a part of their flying. Do you love me? He asks. I love you, he answers. And the world keeps beginning. This is called become becoming. Become becoming. Wait for evening. Then you'll be alone. Wait for the playground to empty. Then call out those companions from childhood. The one who pretended to be dead, the one you told every secret, the one who made a world of any hiding place. And don't forget the one who listened in silence while you wondered, is the universe an empty mirror, a flowering tree, hourglass, birdcage, quiver of arrows, mind itself, Is the universe the sleep of a woman? Does she carry inside her, without her knowing it yet, the word at the end of the story of time? Wait for evening. Then you'll remember the answer. Wait for that color behind the trees. That's the color of Amen. All of time began when you first answered to the names your mother and father gave you. Soon, those names will travel with the leaves. Then you can trade places with the wind. Soon you'll recall that old story beginning with the great herds of stars at pasture. And time, does time blossom, ripen, or branch in two directions, seen and unseen? And what is flesh? Some pollen? Perfume? The very sap? The bread that rises in a house that fails? What table fathered it? Just wait. Soon you'll hear the singing that entrances, the seed of each fruit that wakes falling. Soon you'll become becoming. This is a poem called Nativity. It comes out of an experience of sleeping all in one big bed with my brothers and sisters and my mother and father. And in Chinese households, that's the way we grew up. Nativity. In the dark, a child might ask, "What is the world?" Just to hear his sister promise an unfinished wing of heaven. Just to hear his brother say, "A house inside a house." But most of all, to hear his mother answer, "One more song, then you go to sleep." How could anyone in that bed guess? The question finds its beginning in the answer long growing inside the one who asked, that restless boy, the night's darling. Later, a man lying awake, he might ask it again, just to hear the silence charge him, this night arching over your sleepless wondering. This night, the near ground, every reaching out to overreaches, just to remind himself out of what little earth and duration, out of what immense goodbye, each must make a safe place of his heart before so strange and wild a guest as God approaches. That's God approaching now. You know, I have two sons. I'll read you a poem about one of my sons. I have two sons, and I was on the phone with my oldest one last night, and he's worried about what to declare as a major, and he wants to go into art. And I warned him against it. He said he wants to write poetry and paint and sculpt, and he said, "Well, that's what you've done with your life. Why don't you want me to do it? And I told him, making art is like marrying God. You know, if you want to do that, on the one hand, I'd be really happy, and on the other hand, I'd be terrified for you. And my wife was on the other line, and she was very upset. She said, why do you say things, you know, that are going to confuse him? And, you know, he's obviously going to need a therapist. And but I've had a habit of doing that all my life. When he was 9 years old, I always took pride in, you know, thinking that somehow I was going to tell my children the complete truth, and I thought I was telling him the truth. But when he was 9 years old, the same son, he was taking piano lessons from my sister, his aunt, and she was teaching him the scales, and there's that little mnemonic device you learn, every good boy does fine, you know, E, G, B, D, F. And after 2 years of doing that, he asked me one day, he said, Baba, is that true, every good boy does fine? And I thought hard about it, and I said, no, it's not true, honey. I said, the truth is, every wise child is sad. And he was so heartbroken. And he told my sister this, and she lives downstairs. And one day she came storming up. And she was ready to strangle me, you know. She said, how can you tell your own son that kind of thing? I mean, he's going to be in trouble by the time he's 20. And so now he's 20, and I'm telling him making art is like marrying God. And but so this poem is a kind of conversation with my sister. And sometimes I believe that to be true, and sometimes I don't. You know, every wise child is sad. But the fact of the matter is, it seems to me, if we equate wisdom with disillusionment, that is, becoming free of our illusions, oftentimes that can lead to melancholy or sadness initially. But I'm happy. It makes me happier to think that maybe there's a deeper form of wisdom in which you initially experience melancholy, and then you experience the ecstasy of disillusionment. But I don't know about that. So sometimes this poem sounds like it's saying something true, and sometimes it sounds like I'm just trying to scare my son. I mention in here Union Station. That's a train station in Chicago. And there's a train called the 20th Century. It goes in and out of that station. And when I used to work, I used to have a job, and I would go there every morning and have my coffee just to listen to the announcement. You know, the 20th century is about to arrive. Everybody on board, and the 20th century has now departed. And just for that one hit, you know, then I could go to work. This poem is called Tearing the Page. Tearing the page. Every wise child is sad. Every prince is a member of the grass. Each bud opening opens on the unforeseen. Every wind-strewn flower is God tearing God. And the stars are leaves blown across my grandmother's lap, or the dew multiplying. And of time's many hands, who can tell the bloody from the perfumed, the one that stitches from the one that rips? Every laughing child is forgetful. Every solitary child rules the universe. And the child who can't sleep learns to count, a patient child. And the child who counts negotiates between limit and longing, infinity and subtraction. Every child who listens all night to the wind eventually knows his breathing turns a wheel, pouring time and dream to leave no trace. Though he can't tell what a minute weighs, or is an hour too little or too long. As old as night itself, he's not old enough in the morning to heat his milk on the stove. But he knows about the goodbyes, some of them anyway. The goodbye at the door each morning, a kiss for a kiss. The goodbye at bedtime, stories and songs until it's safe to close his eyes. And maybe he's even heard about the waiting room at Union Station, where dust and echoes climb to the great skylights, accompanied by farewells of the now going, to join the distant farewells of the long gone, while a voice announces the departure of the 20th century for all points west. Yes, every wise child is heartbroken. A sorrowing Pip, he knows the play he's called away from each evening is the beginning and end of order in a human household. He's sure his humming to himself and his rising and falling ball are appointed by ancient laws his own heart tides obey. But he can't tell anybody what he knows. Old enough to knot his shoelaces, but not old enough to unknot them. Old enough to pray, he doesn't always know who to pray to. Old enough to know to close the window when it storms. Old enough to know the rain, given the chance, would fall on him and darken him and darken him the way he himself colors the figures he draws, pressing so hard he tears the page. I'll read one more poem. I want to thank you ahead of time for your generous attention. This poem is called First World. There's a weird little story that goes with this. I have a friend who's worked at Hallmark Cards for 23 years now. No, actually 20 years. We've known each other for 23 years. And he started out as a poet, and he got this great gig at Hallmark. And when he went to work for them, he said, "Look, we're in now. So keep sending me your poems. We're going to try to, you know, change things." He thought he would revolutionize greeting cards. And so, you know, I've been sending him things for years. And it was kind of sad because in the beginning he was all fired up about it, you know. I would send him things and he would say, "Well, it didn't go over well, but let's keep doing it, you know. They just need a little time to understand what it is we're up to." And he had great ideas, you know, about beautiful cards with words that had some literary merit to it. And as the years have gone by, he got meaner to me. He would say things like, "Well, Leung, you know, I read your poem to everybody at a meeting and they all got nosebleeds, so..." And I don't know. And this is one, I'm going to read you one that I sent to him. And we'd come up with this idea of a six-panel folding card that you unfold and this poem would be there and it'd be a beautiful thing. And it was a card to celebrate a sister's birthday. It didn't go over, but the poem is called First World. You might be able to hear in the first line why I wouldn't even, you know. Here we go. This is called First World. Sister, we died in childhood, remember? Yeah, I know. But it's so true, you know, right? I mean, I thought, what is it I want to say to my sister? You know, I want to talk about how we died in childhood, how, you know, the we that were children are no longer. I mean, birthdays are confusing, right? They're both anxiety-ridden, and yet, you know, you're happy. There's cake and presents, but you're a whole year older, right? You're dying at 3 billion cells a minute. I mean, that's a fact, you know. Our bodies are dying at 3 billion cells a minute, and being reborn, too. But anyway, okay, we'll just get the Hallmark thing out, and we'll just hear about this poem. Okay. First World. Sister, we died in childhood, remember? Into birds we died, and they're flying. Toward all of sky we perished so completely, our mother cried, "Where are my little ones?" Into her voice we died, that white singing dispersed in day's greater sentence. And the days, we disappeared into them and what they confided, coming and going. But where? Of noon we died, and of midnight, our longings, the bridges we flung toward the future. Longings we wove in secret, out of worry, wonder, and expectancy. And we died of the future, of calling and mission only we could keep, leaping into faces, trees, toys, houses, seasons, sinking into roots, dreams, and books. Nights beyond the house, we looked up and fell into the known configurations of stars. Nights housed and in bed, we closed our eyes and died into the unknown constellations, the empty basket, the jeweled stare, the table set for a guest. Into our names we died, then passed their precincts, and would not be persuaded every world lay kept in other, bigger hands. We who were haunted by suspicions that where we stood, there stood all worlds. We died. And I've been sowing grass and flowers ever since. We died, and we go on dying. So where would I look for us, except in everything I see? Thank you very much.